This is Focus 580. It's hour number two of our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft, is at the controls. 73 children in the United States have been sentenced to life in prison without parole for crimes committed when they were 13 or 14 years old. Almost two-thirds were children of color, and many were victims of abuse and neglect. According to our guest for this hour of the show, New York University law professor Brian Stevenson, the United States is the only country in the world where children this young have received life sentences. In this hour of the program, we will in part be talking about what happens when children are prosecuted as adults. And indeed, our guest is Brian Stevenson. He is a clinical professor of law at New York University Law School. He is also founder and executive director of the Equal Justice Initiative of Alabama. That's a nonprofit organization that defends the rights of poor and people of color in the state of Alabama. Questions this morning are welcome as we talk. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. At any point here, questions from listeners are certainly welcome. The only thing that we ask of callers is that people are just brief, and we ask that so that we can keep moving along. But of course, at any point here, people are welcome to join the conversation. Again, 333-9455. 9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Professor Stevenson, hello.
Good morning.
Thank you for talking with us.
Happy to.
We appreciate it. We started thinking about this having read some reporting about this particular issue, that is, children young people who committed crimes when they were children being sentenced to life in prison without parole. And I think probably at least some of this was in part might have been stimulated indeed by a report that your organization, the Equal Justice Initiative, did looking at this very thing. And I do want to mention that the Equal Justice Initiative does have a website, and that this report that we will talk about is there. So if people are interested in reading it, go to eji.org and you can see that and find out more about this organization and read that report. But now, having said that, what was it that led you to try to look at this more closely?
Yeah, we knew from a couple of years ago that there were some 2,300 juveniles that had been sentenced to die in prison in the United States. That's as a result of life imprisonment without the possibility of parole sentences. No one had really examined who were the youngest of these kids. And that's what generated our report. We were interested in documenting the number of 13 and 14-year-old kids who had been given these imprisonment until death sentences, and discovered that there were 73, which was much more than we had anticipated. I provide direct representation to many young people, and so I had a client here in Alabama who had been recently sentenced to die in prison at age 14. And so in preparing the appeal in his case, we wanted to see what the state of the law was around the country, and we're quite surprised to find in 19 states 73 kids who had been sentenced to die in prison.
So just to do these numbers again here, where we have something a little bit over 2,200 teens who were 17 or younger sentenced to die, in effect sentenced to die in prison because they were given a life sentence without parole. Then of those 2,200, 73 were 13 or 14 when they committed the crime for which they were sentenced?
That's correct. Right. And another surprising element to this, for me at least, was that some of these young kids had been condemned to die in prison for crimes that were non-homicides. It was a surprising number of cases where people had been accused of participating in a robbery or an assault. We have one case in California where a young man was actually accused of participating in an alleged kidnapping where no one was injured, who ended up with a sentence of life imprisonment without the possibility of parole. And so that was the other surprising aspect of this, that there were so many 13- and 14-year-olds, but also that some of these crimes were not the most serious crimes that we see in the juvenile arena, which is typically homicide, but several of them were non-homicide.
Mm-hmm. I guess that certainly was would be an important question here, because I suppose there would be people who would make the argument that a child or an adolescent who has committed a particularly brutal, violent crime, rape, murder, perhaps it would be appropriate for them to be tried as an adult. And this maybe it gets us into another area that we want to talk about, that is, well, how do you decide whether you're going to try a juvenile as an adult?
But, well, that's right, and there are real questions about the propriety of trying kids as adults. I think in our report, and certainly in our advocacy, we're not taking issue entirely with the legitimacy of trying young kids as adults in some cases. What we're really challenging is that you can conclude that someone at 13 and 14 is so beyond redemption, so beyond rehabilitation, so beyond reform, that they can never change and therefore must spend the rest of their life in prison with no review. What we've sought for all of these cases is the opportunity to have the cases reviewed so that if, as we're encountering, these kids change, they grow, they mature, they have the same opportunity for review that lots of adults have. I mean, what's shocking to me about these cases is that, again, close to two-thirds of them are cases where the judge had to impose this sentence mandatorily. That is, there was no discretion. The judge couldn't consider the age of the child, couldn't consider the background of the child. And we think that that doesn't permit adequate review when you're talking about somebody who's 13 or 14.
Mm-hmm. And that's, I guess, was also we should underscore the fact that you're not necessarily arguing against significant sentences for young people who would commit serious crimes. But what you're saying is that there ought to be some opportunity for review. And so your issue is the life sentence without parole, the fact that that's just that, and there's no possibility at some later date of saying, does it still make sense for this young person to be incarcerated?
Yeah, that's right. I don't believe that a sentence of life without the possibility of parole or death in prison is appropriate for someone who is 13 or 14. It may be that the person struggles in such a way that a parole is frequently and denied for a very long time and potentially even the rest of that person's life. But to not be concerned about whether there is growth, maturation, rehabilitation, reform that would make parole legitimate or possible is, in my judgment, inappropriate. And it is certainly true that most of these kids need intervention and help. I mean, what's tragic is that most of these kids are coming from families that are very dysfunctional, communities that are very violent. They all have suffered a great deal of physical and sexual abuse. They've been taught that violence is the way you resolve conflicts and problems. So I certainly believe that an intervention is needed, but I don't think that the intervention should just be condemnation to death, which is what our court systems have done in most of these cases.
Hmm. I think that historically, although this might be changing, one big difference between the way we deal with adult offenders and we deal with juveniles is that we like to hold on to this idea that for young people, there is the possibility that they could change, that they could change their course. And it seems that what has happened, though, here, particularly over about the last 10 years, as we have in many places lowered the age at which we will try a child as an adult, is that we're starting to perhaps give up on the idea or move away from the idea that kids who have committed serious crimes can indeed change.
I think that's right, and I think it really started about 15 years ago where we were being presented with all of this rhetoric about super predators and a different kind of youth and a different kind of child. Now, many of the people who were proponents of that view have later recanted their their pronouncements and forecasts, but we haven't changed the laws to adjust to that. We lowered the minimum age for trying children as adults. We've used incarceration as a way of managing a larger percentage of our population. I mean, just overall, we had 200,000 people in jails and prisons in 1972. Today, we have 2.3 million people in prison. And the use of mass imprisonment and mass incarceration as response to a whole host of social problems, mental health problems, poverty problems, drug problems, has now been expanded to deal with children who are at risk. And I think it's most tragic for these kids because we know that when you take, you know, very young kids and put them in adult prisons, they're six times more likely to be the victims of sexual assault and rape. They're much more likely to be physically abused and traumatized. And I think we add to the kind of cruelty and violence in the lives of these communities by incarcerating kids that young.
We have as our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Brian Stevenson. He's professor of clinical law at New York University Law School. He's also founder and executive director of the Equal Justice Initiative of Alabama. That's a nonprofit organization that has as its mission defending the rights of poor and people of color in Alabama. They have a website, Equal Justice Initiative, so that's EJI.org if you'd like to look at it, and particularly if you'd like to take a look at more details, in greater detail, this report that we have talked about that they have done, taking a look at cases where 13 and 14-year-old children here in the United States have been tried as adults and sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers, and we do have a caller to bring into the conversation in Champaign, line number one.
Yes, hello. Professor Stevenson, I've read about your work in Alabama, I think, in connecting with death penalty cases, among other things, in trying to bring about justice in the Alabama criminal justice system. I want to ask two preliminary questions that require short answers. One is, the majority of these 13 or 14-year-olds, are they of the African-American racial group?
Yes, they are. Two-thirds of the kids are kids of color. Over half are black.
Okay. Secondly, my question is, and this is the region of the country where many of these cases, at least a disproportionate number of these cases, are they from the Mid-South and the Deep South?
There are, but that second question is a slightly less expected answer. There were some surprising states who showed up on the rolls of the 19 states that have the kids this age. I mean, there, a lot of them are the places where I suspect you may imagine: Alabama, Arkansas, Florida, Mississippi, North Carolina. But there's some other states that showed up that were surprising: Michigan, Illinois, Pennsylvania, California. Actually, the largest number of these kids is in the state of Pennsylvania. Wisconsin is on the list, Illinois is on the list, Michigan is on the list. And so there's a pretty surprising geographic distribution of cases with this population, at least.
And my final question, and it deals with the criminal justice system generally, and I think what you've studied in terms of these 13 and 14-year-olds receiving life without parole. And I think I read this in a column written by Bob Herbert, an African-American columnist for the New York Times, where he talked about how the criminal justice system in the United States is really used as a means to socially control young black males. And I wondered what your take on that assertion would be.
Well, I don't think there's any question that the use of the criminal justice system and mass incarceration generally has had a devastating impact on communities of color, particularly young black men. And I think that there is some support for the notion that it has become such a serious threat to young men of color that it has to be identified with some other institutions that have been threats to the African-American community as an institutional threat. And I say that because, you know, one out of three black men between the ages of 18 and 30 is in jail, on probation, or parole, or under criminal justice control. That's a crisis. That's a real challenge. And the greatest number of African-American men in jail and prison is not because they've committed violent crimes or done things that other people in other segments of the population don't do. They're there largely for drug-related offenses. And so I do think, yes, that the criminal justice system has become a huge obstacle for equal justice in this country. I think that young men of color, particularly African Americans, are presumed guilty. They have to overcome a presumption of guilt when arrested. That means they're going to have better legal assistance than other folks. And all of those things conspire to create an environment that has become very, very challenging for African Americans and Latinos and other racial minorities in this country.
Thank you, Professor Steve.
All right. Thank you for the call. Others are certainly welcome to call 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. One other point I want to give you the opportunity to make, and I think that I mentioned it at the beginning, though, one of the findings of your report is that there is there's nowhere else in the world, or perhaps there might only be one other place in the world, where children this young, 13, 14, have been sentenced to life in prison without parole.
That's right. The United States is the only country in the world known to intentionally condemn 13 and 14-year-old children to die in prison. This sentence of life imprisonment without the possibility of parole is specifically prohibited under international law. And there are covenants and treaties that every country in the world has signed to protect children from these kinds of sentences, except the United States and Somalia. Somalia is the only other non-signatory to the language that protects kids from these kinds of sentences. And I think it does reveal something more troubling about the credibility and the integrity of human rights in the United States for our global advocacy on these issues. Until 2 years ago, we executed juveniles in the United States. It was only when the Supreme Court, in a 5-4 decision out of Missouri, declared that the death penalty was unconstitutional for juveniles, that we became one of the only countries in the world that was executing juveniles. Mm. So I think that it has isolated us with regard to human rights for children, that we have tolerated these kinds of sentences for kids this young.
And I suppose, is there some possibility you think someone would be willing to mount an argument that says, essentially, that there's not a lot of difference between a death sentence and putting someone in jail without parole? You're sentencing them to die, to live out all of their life and to die in prison. So I suppose one could say that there's not a whole lot of difference really between those two. So then if you make the argument that you can't, that we're not going to execute children, then does that give you some kind of place to stand to make the argument that says perhaps the idea of a life sentence without parole is we can argue against that essentially on the same kind of grounds?
No, I think you've anticipated the argument exactly. That is the argument that we're making. The court concluded that it was cruel and unusual punishment in violation of the Eighth Amendment to execute juveniles. We're arguing that it is similarly cruel and unusual, at least with regard to 13 and 14-year-olds, to sentence them to die in prison. We know so much more about children that age than we used to. We now know from new brain science that kids who are 13 and 14, as a neurological, as a biological matter, don't have the parts of the brain developed yet that allow for more mature judgments, for more complicated judgments. And we know that that will change. I mean, what's tragic for me as a lawyer who represents some of these kids, is when I start representing these kids, they're very different than they are in a few years. And not only are they physically different, they get bigger. They're emotionally different. They can handle things differently at 17, 18, 19 than they could at 13 and 14. They're psychologically different. Many of them, most of them actually, have never had anyone engage them from a perspective of commitment and concern that's about them. It's not about something else. And what I find sometimes just incredibly sad about these cases is how much promise and how much progress they make when you show them some commitment, when you create an environment for them where they're not at risk of being shot or stabbed or killed or traumatized in some way, and you just start working with them. And it's persuaded me that we should never believe that we know everything we need to know about the value, the life, the hope, the promise of someone at age 13. We're just more complicated than that. And I think these sentences that presume that we know enough about this 13-year-old to know that they will never be mature enough, evolved enough, human enough that they could be released from, is a very misguided view.
Let's talk with someone else. This is also someone in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. I guess I have two questions, and one you began to answer. It strikes me as you're talking that I just wonder if you've thought about what is it about the United States that we do tolerate this kind of sentencing? Yeah, you talked about the credibility, human rights, et cetera,
yeah.
But have you thought about sort of some basic reasons why you think we would tolerate life in prison for 13 and 14-year-olds and until a couple years ago sentencing them to death?
Yeah, it's a very good question. I think part of it has to do with the way in which we have fallen prey to the politics of fear and anger.
Yeah.
You know, this country has been, in my judgment, polluted by so much rhetoric aimed at inspiring fear and inspiring anger. And it's, you know, you see it all across the political spectrum, but it's be angry about this, be fearful about that. Our media coverage, I think, plays into that. But we've created this country where the consciousness around crime is one of anger, outrage, and fear. And when you create that kind of environment, it becomes easy to do things that would seem just unimaginable outside of that environment. And whether you're talking about, you know, policies relating to terrorism or policies relating to individual crimes, it's a very powerful formula for doing the unthinkable. And I think that's been part of it. I mean, you know, why do we have the highest rate of incarceration in the world? How is it that we could tolerate having the prison population go from 200,000 in the early 70s to 2.3 million today? And sadly, once we get to a prison population of 2.3 million today, there are economic interests for sustaining that. You know, there aren't a lot of politicians out there saying we need to reduce the number of people in jails and prisons. We've created, actually, these very perverse incentives to keep that kind of prison population. And I don't see the kind of embarrassment, the kind of shame, the kind of regret about that that you would expect. You even see sometimes gloating and celebration around being tough on these issues. I think all of those things have created an environment where we have an easy time demonizing people, turning people into problems, turning people into crimes. You know, when I talk about this with students and people, I just have a very different view just on my work with people in poor and minority communities. I believe that each person is more than the worst thing they've ever done. And I say that and believe that because I guess I need to believe it for myself, but I believe it for my clients as well. I believe it for everybody. And I think that if somebody tells a lie, they're not just a liar. If they take something that doesn't belong to them, they're not just a thief. Even if they kill someone, they're not just a killer. And we've got to be concerned about what else is this person, who else is this person, before we can properly sentence, before we can properly judge what the right outcome should be. But I think that mindset has been really diminished over the last 20 years in criminal justice policy. And we've gotten comfortable with some, I think, pretty disturbing realities like putting 13- and 14-year-old kids in prison until they die.
Wow. My second question is, what can we do to help you in your efforts to change all of this?
Well,
not only the country's mindset, but also specifically the incarceration for life of 13 and 14. Well, not only 13 and 14-year-olds. I think any youth, not, you know, that's not considered an adult. So I guess that's in most states, what, 18 and younger, or younger than 18?
That's correct, younger than 18, and I greatly appreciate that question as well. Well, as is indicated, we do have a website. We'd love to hear from folks. If you contact us from any of the 19 states that we're doing this advocacy in, we're trying to identify people who can play a role in that. A lot of these kids have been isolated from their families. They just came from households where there just wasn't much support there.
Right.
When we started working with them, some of them had not been in contact with anyone for years who could just play a positive role. And so we are constantly trying to link interested people with our clients as pen pals, as supporters. When we start doing advocacy in particular states, we want to engage people to help us with that advocacy because half of this is education. You know, the other half is persuasion. So, you know, please feel free to contact us through the website and, you know, identify what of those kinds of issues that, you know, you might be available to help with. I mean,
and so you're doing some of, I assume then, you're doing some of that in Illinois.
Yes, that's correct. Illinois is one of the states.
Downstate as well as Chicago?
Yes, that's right.
So on your website there would be potential contacts and so forth?
That's right. If you write to us and let us know you have an interest in that, we will then begin the process of trying to link you with one of the folks either in your area. And they don't have to be in your area, but certainly with someone. And that's certainly one way of helping.
And then your idea is to link up, you know, let's just argue that I was interested in this, linking me up with one of these youth that is incarcerated because they have no one else?
That's right.
I mean, that's not the only reason, but...
Yeah. If you're interested in corresponding with the kids, we think that can play a really important role. You know, there will be advocacy, commutation, clemency advocacy in some instances. Education advocacy is a way to help. So all of those things are possible for people who want to play a role in trying to challenge this.
Are most of these youth, or is there a pattern with this? I'm assuming if they're given life in prison in Illinois, I believe it's that they have to have been accused of a double homicide to get life in prison. And if it is then, if they are accused of a double homicide, I believe in Illinois, I'm not 100% sure of this, but the chances of their going to a really maximum security or really tough prison, not getting educational opportunities and so forth is pretty high because it's a double homicide.
Well, that's right. Interestingly enough, not all of these cases are double homicides in Illinois. There are some folks who ended up with these sentences because just the number of the crimes, and it's worth pointing out that in virtually all of these cases, there are older co-defendants who are typically primarily culpable for the offense.
Yes, exactly.
But what we don't do in the law is basically discriminate between who's most culpable and who's least culpable because of the mandatory sentencing that sometimes is connected with the way these crimes get punished. And so, you know, as a result of that, they end up with the same harsh sentence. And you're right that in many jurisdictions, once you've been certified to stand trial as an adult, you are treated as an adult, and you will end up in these very, very difficult, very, very violent prisons. Some of the most difficult prisons in the country is where these kids end up getting sent because their classification, based on the sentence, puts them in that most dangerous category. And that's one of the real tragic side stories of the work that we've done is we've encountered a lot of young people who have just had brutal, horrific, nightmarish experiences as young kids in these adult prisons.
Right. Okay, thank you so much for your work. It is definitely needed.
Well, I appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you for the call. Let me again introduce our guest for anyone who might have just tuned in. We're talking with Brian Stevenson. He is professor of clinical law at New York University Law School. He's also founder and executive director of the Equal Justice Initiative of Alabama. This is a nonprofit organization that defends the rights of the poor and people of color in the state of Alabama. If you're interested in reading about this organization, their website is EJI, EqualJusticeInitiative.org, or you just type Equal Justice Initiative into your web browser. I'm sure you can find it, and you will be able to find out more about this organization, and also if you are interested in reading the report that they prepared on this subject here we've been talking about, that is children, 13 and 14-year-old kids, sentenced to life in prison without parole. You can download that report and read about it there. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana is the number to call if you'd like to join in the conversation. Toll free, 800-222-9455. And we do have indeed another caller here in Gibson City, not too far away, line number two.
Yes, hello.
Yes.
I missed the first part of your program. I'm sorry, but I'm very interested in this. And I wondered if you heard of Howard Zier and his restorative justice program. And I know he mainly works with youth and keeping the youth out of courts.
Yes, I am familiar with that. It's, I think, a quite wonderful idea of trying to approach some of the problems, particularly the problems that we see with young kids, from a different framework that is not pure punishment but restoration, trying to get some reconciliation between the communities and the people who are victimized with the people who commit these crimes. I've seen it work really well in situations where there is an openness to that. Unfortunately, what we see in too many jurisdictions, though, is this really harsh, punitive response to the plight of some of these kids. And what I think is frustrating about that is that, you know, these are kids who have largely been served, been failed by these same systems, these same policies, these same decision makers. I mean, a lot of my clients are kids who were, you know, physically abused at 3, sexually abused at 6, threatened and really challenged by violent environment, households, communities at 10 and 11, with no intervention, with no help, with no assistance. And then when they're involved in a crime that is violent and destructive, they're arrested and prosecuted as an adult with no ability to consider the mitigation or the background. And I think that's what's incomplete about what we're doing with these cases. I think restorative justice of the type that you're mentioning has a much greater potential to help us kind of understand where the problems are and how to solve them in a more holistic way.
Well, I want to thank you. What you are doing, and I, you know, I really appreciate that. And I come from a biblical background that does not believe in killing and going to war. So I really appreciate your efforts. And I'll hang up and listen.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you. Well, again, other questions, comments are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Just real quick here, again, to pick on another aspect of this. We talked about the fact that your organization, the Equal Justice Initiative, was particularly interested in looking at juveniles tried as adults and then what happened with the youngest of them, and that you did indeed document these cases, 73 cases where children who were 13 and 14 had been tried as adults, sentenced to life in prison without parole, two-thirds of them kids of color, half of those African-American, many of them had been abused or neglected. And I think one other point I'd have to make that here, these were families that did not have the resources to hire high-priced attorneys. And so one also would have to get the, you know, question the role of inadequate representation in the outcomes here that we're talking about.
Oh, no question about it. It's a huge role. I think very few of these kids would have ended up with these sentences had they been able to afford better legal representation. I mean, one of the sad realities about the criminal justice system in this country as it stands right now is it's incredibly wealth-sensitive. I mean, we have a system of justice that treats you better if you're rich and guilty than if you're poor and innocent. And the wealth factor is enormous. A lot of these young people were represented by lawyers. When we contacted the lawyers in many of these cases, a surprising number of these cases, didn't remember that their client was only 13 or 14 at the time of the offense. In several of the cases, the clients were actually instructed to plead guilty and told they would get sentences between 10 and 15 years, only to find out that it was a mandatory sentence of life imprisonment without parole. In several of the cases, the lawyers filed no appeals after these sentences were imposed. So inadequate legal assistance is absolutely a part of this story. I don't think any of these children would have ended up in the situation where they ended up had they had the ability to get better legal help.
Yeah.
It's another, I think, tragic component to the problem that these cases represent.
Well, this, you know, maybe this gives us an opportunity here as we're moving into our last 15 minutes or so to widen the frame a little bit, because I'd certainly know that going back to the time when you were in law school, you were very struck by and moved by this particular matter, you know, that is how poor, particularly poor people fare in the justice system and the inequality of the system when it comes to people who have means and people who don't. And that was really why you got involved in doing the work that you're doing and started the Equal Justice Initiative. I don't know if it's, I suppose you've already said it in a way, whether it's too global a statement to make, but it does certainly seem that one bottom line of justice in America and the ultimate outcomes is you do have to look at the person, look at the accused.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, it's very, very troubling. I mean, we've increased the number of people being sent to jail and prison so dramatically, but we haven't increased the resources available to make sure that the convictions and the sentences are reliable, that they're fair, that they're just. I mean, in the death penalty context, where we do a lot of work, you all in Illinois have had this experience of having to confront lots of innocent people who are wrongly convicted, but nationwide, we now know that 130 people who have been sentenced to death, and these are the cases where we spend the most time, we make the biggest effort to try to get reliable convictions, and we now know that 130 people were innocent, were wrongly convicted. With slightly more than 1,100 executions, that means for every 8 people we've executed, we've identified an innocent person on death row. That's a really shocking rate of error. And I think if we were talking about any segment of the population other than the poor, other than the marginalized, other than the despised, it would not be acceptable. But in too many jurisdictions, it remains a continuing problem. Here in Alabama, where I work, two-thirds of the people on death row were represented by lawyers who, by statute, could not get paid more than $1,000 for their out-of-court time in preparing the case for trial. It's a really shockingly low rate of compensation. We have no right to counsel for people on death row for post-conviction appeals. And so I have clients on death row here in Alabama who are literally dying for legal representation, cannot find a lawyer to process their appeals. And I think that does say something about the way we have failed to confront the challenges created by poverty and inequality with regard to the criminal justice system. It is, I think, a huge issue that we have not done a better job to meet the legal needs of the poor and to not kind of contextualize the problems of poverty in a more healthy way.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly, I don't think we'd have to go back very far, very many years, before we would find overwhelmingly positive support among the American population for capital punishment. And that is something, though, in the recent past, that has started to change as there have been more demonstrated cases that the system made a mistake, that people were convicted of crimes that they did not commit. And I think that we're now, I think people are willing to entertain the notion that people who were not guilty of the crimes that they were convicted of were in fact executed, and that if for no other reason one might think about opposing the death penalty because there's no going back.
I think that's right. I mean, I think if you could sort of lift the cloud of anger, if you could get this kind of the fog of fear out of the room, I think we would see some things that would absolutely push us toward reform, that would change the way we think about some of these things. And I think that's the challenge, is getting people informed in a way that allows them to really evaluate what's going on. I don't think questions like the death penalty and even the sentences that are imposed on these young kids are really questions that orbit around the propriety of the crime for the offender. To me, it's not a question, does this person deserve to die for the crime that they have committed? To me, it's a question is, does this state deserve to kill when it is done so poorly in meeting the needs of the poor, when it's still so compromised by race bias and race discrimination, when it is struggling to be reliable and fair and accurate and just? These sentences that for which there is no recovery, the death penalty, et cetera, require a perfect system of justice or a better system of justice than the ones that we currently have. And I think that is a reason to rethink the legitimacy of some of these punishments, no matter what your views on the morality of things like the death penalty may be.
Mm-hmm. I know this is the kind of thing that certainly has been up for discussion other places. It has here in the state of Illinois. It's been a while since I've looked at this in detail, but I certainly know that here in the state of Illinois, there were various task forces. There was one that was made up of judges. There was one that was made up of lawyers. There was one that was made up of legislators, taking a look at the death penalty system in the state and what was wrong with it. And rather than saying, well, we just shouldn't have the death penalty anymore, they looked at a number of issues. They looked at things like the quality of the attorneys that were representing people, and wanted to make certain that if someone was going to represent a client who was eligible for the death sentence, that person be experienced and a good lawyer so that they would get good representation. And they did things like, they said, well, we ought to create a kind of a fund that could be used by attorneys in some of the smaller counties that don't have a lot of resources, so that they would have some kind of money that they could hire forensic experts and they could do testing. So what they're trying to do is improve the functioning of the system, rather than simply saying, well, the system can't be fixed, it's irredeemable, so that we shouldn't be doing it. I guess here the question I'm going at is whether you feel that somehow it's the mechanism of trying someone and imposing the sentence can be fixed so that we do everything we can to keep to an absolute minimum people who are unjustly executed, or whether that's whether it's something, whether it's simply beyond fixing.
Well, oddly enough, I actually think both things. I mean, I think that we absolutely have to improve the system, that we need to have better lawyers, we need to be more committed to rigorous examination of the evidence. I think all of those things are needed. And I think they're needed for all criminal cases, not just cases where the death penalty is imposed. Because obviously if you end up with a sentence of life imprisonment without the possibility of parole and you're innocent, that's as tragic in many ways as a death sentence, or 20 years or 30 years. Whenever our system performs unfairly, is unjust, is excessive, is biased, the integrity of the criminal justice system is compromised, and we ought to be very motivated to deal with that. On the other hand, there is no way we can provide the kind of clarity and reliability that I think the death penalty demands, and as a result of it, I just don't think we should have it. And as a policy matter, the death penalty isn't a critical tool in public safety. I mean, it hasn't been established to deter or anything else. It, you know, we do this as a way of expressing our fear and anger. It's a cultural symbol more than it's a useful tool in the punishment scheme. And if you're going to engage in something that is largely symbolic, that is expressive, then it absolutely has to be, you know, accurate and fair and reliable. You can't afford to have the kinds of mistakes that I think we've seen and will always see, even with improvements of the kind that you've detailed in Illinois and some other jurisdictions. I mean, human beings make mistakes. And because we make mistakes, we have to have some humility when we consider what kind of punishments we impose. And I think the arrogance of the death penalty, the arrogance of capital punishment, is that we presume to be mistake-free enough that we can impose a punishment for which there is no remedy, no recovery, once we determine that we have, in fact, made a mistake. And it's why most democratic countries have stepped away from it. I mean, the United States is one of the few countries in the Western world that still has the death penalty. But I think, you know, more broadly, we could be spending resources that are now consumed by those cases to provide improvements in other areas of the system where there's also a very compelling need for reform. I mean, whether you're in prison for 10 years or 5 years or 20 years, if you're there unjustly, that's really tragic. That's really a shame, and it implicates the quality of the society to tolerate that.
We have about 6-7 minutes left in this part of Focus. Just very quickly, again, to introduce the guest, Brian Stevenson. He is professor of clinical law at New York University Law School, founder and executive director of the Equal Justice Initiative of Alabama. We have two callers here. We'll try to get them both. First, Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello. What sectors of our society, or our civil society, are driving the vast increase in incarceration levels? For example, private for-profit prisons, who thereby contribute to politicians, do they have much of an influence?
Yeah, that's a very good question. Yes, you'll see that. I mean, the prison, prison industry, prison building has been a growing sector in the American economy for the last 20 years. Have become very, very influential at state legislatures. You do see that the growth of private prisons is one example of that influence. Correctional unions in some states, the one consequence of mass incarceration is that we've now hired thousands of people to be correctional guards, who have also become invested in maintaining high rates of incarceration. And then the other part of it is the role of the so-called war on drugs. We've created a whole industry around prosecuting, investigating drug offenses, and that has generated a lot of these arrests and convictions and long sentences.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. And we'll go to another caller here, and that would be Champaign County, line two. Hello.
Hi. You mentioned super predator, that whole line of discourse, and you said that most academics aren't really backing it anymore, but it seems to be a pervasive thing anyway, and it's reflected in most recently, you know, James Watkins' remark about genetic disposition to being more stupid, as it were, which because that seems to me is explains a lot about why we have it. We have this legacy of colonial and slavery and the mentality, and it's not just race either. There's a blame the victim of the poor kind of thing that these people just can't do anything. You know, they're irremediable or whatever.
Right.
I'll let you go. Thank you.
No, I think you're quite right. I mean, the person who used this term, super predator, John DeIlio, is a Princeton researcher who is primarily responsible for advocating that, forecasting this wave of violent crime from young people. He's the person in the early 90s that started giving that, using that language, but about 10 years later he acknowledged that the forecast that he had predicted did not come true, that he had overstated the problem, that the use of the term was inappropriate. And that's what I was referring to, but I think you're exactly right that there are still folks out there that engage in this othering. You know, these are not really children, they're something else. These are not like your kids, not like the people you know and love, these are something else, and that capacity to treat people differently is part of what we see behind a lot of these sentences. We see it as a statement about them, not as a statement about us. And I guess, of course, my problem is that I believe you judge the character of society, you judge the civility of society and the community, not by how you treat the rich and the privileged and the favored and the celebrated, but how you treat the rejected, the hated, the condemned, the poor, the disadvantaged. So I see in these sentences not just statements about these young kids, but about the rest of us, about who we are, about what our values are, what our norms are, what our vision is. And that's why I think this issue is such a profound one for the kind of the morality and character of our society.
We had talked about the fact that at least there has been in recent years some discussion of capital punishment, mm-hmm. and whether or not this system is just, whether this constitutes, in as we would say, cruel and unusual punishment. And at least it's gotten that at the level of the ultimate sanction, it has gotten people's attention, some people's attention. I wonder, though, whether, as you said a little bit earlier, said, you know, even if a person is sentenced to 5 years in prison or 10 years in prison for a crime that they didn't commit, there's a fundamental justice issue here, and we should do what we could to make sure that that doesn't happen. I guess I'm wondering, yes, at the level of the ultimate sanction, you got people's attention, but whether there, you know, how much interest there is generally in problems with the justice system, and how responsive people are to the, you know, to that idea that maybe we ought to make some kind of changes.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's one of the great challenges of our time. I mean, I think you're right that when you take away the kind of the headlights that go with some of these really extreme sentences, it becomes harder to get people to look. But I think it's one of the great challenges. We've got now some 6 million people on probation and parole in this country. In many states, you lose the right to vote as a result of a Welfare Reform Act passed in 1996. You can't get public housing. You can't get food stamps. Your ability to get publicly supported medical assistance is limited. We are creating in this country, through mass incarceration and some of these policies, a whole new segment of the population that have become our untouchables. They are the 21st century untouchables of American society. And at no point in our history have we so marginalized people that they have been excluded from even the fragile social safety network that we create. And I think that's an indictment of the entire community. And it will come back to haunt us. It will undermine everything we try to do to advance justice and equality in this country until we deal with it. So I do think that we have to see this problem as a huge problem that has to be addressed in a lot of ways. And whether you're talking about 13- and 14-year-old kids, or you're talking about people who are wrongly convicted, or you're talking about the poor, or people of color, whatever, it's all part of, I think, a growing challenge, you know, to make our rhetoric match up with our conduct when it comes to equality and justice and human rights.
Mm. It seems like it's an issue. Being tough on crime, at least, is an issue that's always had traction politically. I don't imagine probably too many people running for office could go wrong saying, I'm going to be tough on crime. I'm going to lock up criminals. I believe in the rights of the people who have been victims of crimes. And, you know, maybe we've spent too much time thinking about the rights of people who are accused, and we really ought to be concentrating on the rights of the victims, you know, that sort of thing. That's the kind of thing that, for a candidate, I'm not sure you can actually go wrong doing that.
I think that's right, and it's precisely the politics of fear and anger that have led to so many of these policies. But I think if the larger electorate becomes more educated, more aware of these issues, they can become more demanding. I mean, you know, saying to somebody, to the population, we're going to be really tough after you've been raped, robbed, and murdered is not really a sensible crime policy. And talking about the problems of crime and the problems of poverty and the problems of race more broadly is ultimately what we have to insist. But it is up to us. I mean, it's the people, it's the listeners, it's the the ordinary folks who have to demand more from politicians, from policymakers, from legislators, than this tough-on-crime rhetoric, than the, you know, just lock them up and throw away the key solutions, because we ultimately know that it's not really a solution.
Well, we are going to have to stop there because we're here at the end of the time. We want to again thank our guest, Brian Stevenson. He's professor of clinical law at New York University Law School. He is also founder and executive director of the Equal Justice Initiative of Alabama. This is a nonprofit that defends the rights of poor and people of color in Alabama. If you're interested in finding out more about the Equal Justice Initiative, they do indeed have a website, eji.org, and there you can read this report that we have mentioned here, taking a look at death sentences in prison. Literally, what we're talking about is life in prison without parole for kids who are 13 and 14 years old. Professor Stevenson, thanks very much.
My pleasure.